We do have time for questions and comments. Okay. People need to settle down before we get to that. I recognize the woman to my right at the microphone.
Okay. I have to catch my breath, too. I just wanted to say that there's someone who really should have been here and would have loved to have been here. About a year ago, next month, I think it was April 15th, there was a court case in South Carolina where a woman who was raped by her husband, and he was so proud of it that he filmed it on video, she took the case to court, to criminal court, and in less than an hour, the jury acquitted, even though they saw the video. And it was just, of course, before the same kind of thing happened in the Rodney King situation. They believed the defense argument. Her name, by the way, is Trish Crawford. They believed the defense argument that is the message of pornography, that this is what she wanted. This is in spite of the fact that you could see the knife in the video, that you could see that she was duct taped with her mouth shut, that you could see that she was struggling, and of course, despite the fact that she was in the court testifying to what had happened to her. But the defense argument specifically was that her cries, I can barely say this, her cries were cries of pleasure and not of pain. And that's the argument that the jury bought. So I would have loved to have been able to say to her when I talked to her after that, I'm sorry, I'm Laura X from the National Clearinghouse on Marital and Date Rape in Berkeley. Anyway, I would have loved to have been able to say to her, well, you didn't get satisfaction from that jury, but there's an ordinance that you could turn to. So I just want to echo what Andrea said, that we really need to organize, so there will be for women like that.
Thank you for that. I recognize many circumstances in that has been so painful in the last 10 years, because there are many cases in which we would have wanted to say to a woman who's been sexually abused in such a way or another way, now you can bring a civil suit under the ordinance. In this case, the rapist made the pornography. The woman to my left, and please identify yourself.
I'm Jan Woodcock. I'm from Mount Pleasant, Michigan. I'm an activist. I have a few words to people in this room who may be reluctant activists. Activism is the most exciting and passionate thing that I've ever done in my life. It began for me in a battered women's shelter in the early 80s. And I've become active in the anti-pornography movement in the last 4 years. In the evolution that I have made in my transition from working with battered women to working with raped women to working with incest victims to working with prostitutes and pornographed people, I have finally drawn the line on the continuum of understanding that prostitutes experience the most political, economic, social, and emotional and physical battering in our country. And I would plead to any people who are involved in the domestic violence movement and anyone else who can make that connection to get involved in this and use what you know about the battered women's movement to our advantage in that. As I have been an activist over the years, I've always received threats. I received them when I worked in the shelter, and I receive them now. And the thing that I always remind myself is what cowards those people are. They are cowards, and usually they will run if you stand up and say boo. They will threaten you with words, and they will threaten you with their power, and they will threaten you with their systems. But if we collectively fight them, they will not win. They are counting on us to be intimidated. And then I remember the words of Andrea Dworkin, that we must be willing to commit every crime that we are going to be punished for, whether we act or not. and a very timely piece of advice that I got from Ann Simonton recently. Figure out what it is you want to say and say it. I have learned that we must say it loud, say it with conviction, and stand up for all of our sisters who cannot speak. Thank you.
The woman on my right.
My name is Amy Ellman, and I have a question. I've heard several lawyers today profess a great concern about doing something about pornography. I've heard various suggestions, like, for example, that we now are in a better position to be able to effectively use obscenity law. I have also heard a suggestion that we, for example, try to pass a law against violent pornography. I know that this is being done, has already been done here, has already been done in, for example, various countries throughout Europe. I have seen that what has happened instead is it has provided pornographers a new blueprint for adjusting slightly how they want to produce pornography. For example, child pornography, now that we have law against child pornography, they just use women in a slightly different way. For example, using girls who are 18 years old and one day. I was wondering if perhaps you could address this notion that somehow consciousness has changed so that we can effectively use obscenity law. I'd like to hear you speak to that issue.
Obscenity law is not effective. It will not be effective. I don't think there is a shift that will make it be effective in this country. Everything about it is, aside from, I mean, there's a connection between the fact that it misdescribes the problem and the fact that it is worthless. And the more pornography there is, the more pornography sets community standards. The pornography gets there before we do. It's so nice that we have all this consciousness, but pornography is creating the consciousness of the communities that then set the level of standards according to the obscenity test. In terms of whether people will recognize that materials that are violent or that are aggressive or that are horrific toward women appeal to the prurient interest, nothing's changed there really, because they really, the more consciousness we raise, the less likely they are to want to say that the violent material appeals to their prurient interest. So that knocks out that part of the test. Then we come, I mean, there's other parts of it, but we come in particular to the part which I think is a major obstacle, and I contemplated with some trepidation in Canada as well, and that is the question of value. The materials that if they have literary, political, artistic, or scientific value, then that's a knockout. I mean, it can be that you can even get over the other aspects of the test. Now, that is where it becomes totally clear, if it isn't already, that the issue of harm has nothing whatever to do with obscenity law. In other words, you can have a aesthetic snuff film. You can have a film that shows the vagina able to expand more than anyone ever thought you could put that much into it, and they use it to show doctors, see, look, it can get this big. You have all sorts of weird, you know, all sorts of amazing positions that women are forced to be in. And medical people will testify that they use that to train doctors, and therefore it has educational value. Artistic, educational, those sorts of things. What it means is that women's value is weighed against the value of the materials. It means that harm to us ultimately can be outweighed if the value of harming us is seen to be higher than our value is seen to be. That's written in there. It has nothing to do with consciousness. You know, we can't do that.
Yeah, and can I just say, in terms of, now this is a different, this is now on a different aspect of this question. One of the terrible problems of living in a liberal political culture is that people keep talking about consciousness. They keep talking about changing people's minds. I'm happy if people's minds change. But I think that we've been clear, all of us, all day long here, that we are talking about things people do. We're talking about things that happen. And if you haven't changed the consciousness of the pimp and the rapist and the pornographer, you haven't changed the consciousness that the ordinance could help to change. I was very struck being in my mid-40s. I grew up with all the conflict around segregation in the South. And some of that struggle was legal and some of that struggle was direct action. And one of the arguments that used to be used against legal change was that you can't change people's hearts and minds by passing a law. Well, yes, you can. It's been proven. And we can change hearts and minds by passing the ordinance.
I would say one more thing about the obscenity question.
And that is that, this is about the obscenity question, I think that people perhaps are not as clear as they might be on the lack of a meaningful equality guarantee in this country. And, you know, we remain in the grip of this stupid approach to equality, which is, you know, which sees actually changing the situation as part of the problem rather than part of the solution. And so long as that goes on, the major precondition for being able to do anything with any other area of law in a way that would take equality seriously is not there. Just isn't.
Yeah, I mean, I swear. 3 seconds. You can see when we taught what class was like. We, you can also, I think, begin to understand something about the reasons that people have been so angry about the ordinance. The ordinance is designed to do something. And what it's designed to do is to take power away from those who have it and who have too much of it, and give it to the people that they're hurting. It is almost antagonistic to the liberal idea of changing people's minds through argumentation.
My left, please identify yourself.
My name is Wendy Stock, and I'm a psychologist and a researcher on pornography. One of the things that Andrea Dworkin has said in some of her talks is she's asked the question, how many research studies does it take to show that hanging a woman from a meat hook is a bad thing? I'm paraphrasing. I'm one of those people that's engaged in doing studies or planning on doing studies to help this effort. I have a questionnaire that is titled Women's Experiences of Pornography. What I want to do is get it out on a mass scale nationally to as large a sample as possible. I brought it with me to this conference. The few that I put out on the table got taken, and the sample one that's taped down keeps getting covered over. If people want to help by getting a copy of this from me, give me your cards with your addresses or write them down, I'm able to send one copy out. I don't have a research grant yet. The reason for the questionnaire is, although we have had documentation of pornography's harm in the Minneapolis hearings, that has apparently not convinced enough people. It hasn't gotten out to the mainstream. In fact, even though we have a lot of people here today, this is not the mainstream. So the intent that I would have for this data is not only to publish it in some arcane journal, which would be nice, but also to publish it in a mass media, kind of a paperback book that women could read in order to break the silence on a mass scale. And I think that that would be one way, at least, to mobilize this effort and to spread it beyond just a few academics and students and sympathetic supporters. So I ask for your help, and what I could do is send out one copy, and then people will need to make copies on their own and give it out to as many women as you can. Thank you very much.
The woman to my right.
My name is Marna. This is Mary. We're with the Whisper Action Group in Minneapolis and St. Paul. And before I talk about the case, we're going to talk about someone here just asked if I wouldn't thank you, Catherine, for your work you've been doing in Bosnia and looking at rape as a war crime. Yeah.
I have been retained by women in Croatia and in Bosnia-Herzegovina to represent them in connection with the genocide and torture and mass rape and murder. And on Friday, we served Radovan Karadzic with a lawsuit. On together with the now Legal Defense and Education Fund in New York, which is serving as local counsel for the suit, on behalf of a named woman who was mass raped, including in a rape death camp, forcibly impregnated as well, also who had twin sons, one of whom was decapitated in her arms, the other of whom is still alive. On their behalf, the three of them, and two women's organizations, one of which is comprised of all women survivors of the atrocities, which are, of course, based on sex and ethnicity in Bosnia-Herzegovina, and are addressed against Muslim women and Croatian women. We brought this suit for damages and, get this, an injunction. The injunction is to stop the ethnic cleansing, that Radovan Karadzic should immediately cease and desist from doing. So thanks for mentioning it.
We want to talk about a case that we've been working on in Minneapolis where African-American woman was raped by her ex-fiancé, who was a Minneapolis police officer, Officer John Moorman, if you'd like to know his name. He's been with the force about 5 years. In his 5 years, he has a horrible reputation. He is known for soliciting African-American women in his beat. He is known to perpetrate against women used in prostitution, and he has several complaints against him. His victim came forward knowing that her only protection was to go public. However, nobody really picked up on that, and the case got very little press. And the action group, we started to come forward because we knew that that case would get lost because he's a police officer and a white police officer. What I want to say briefly about that is that we waited from end of August, until I believe January, before the county attorney office finally decided to make a decision that they had to decline charges because the Minneapolis police internal affairs messed up the investigation so badly. So we had the county attorneys blaming the police and the police blaming the county attorneys. Anyways, what we found out, one of the assaults was videotaped. And that videotape we were hoping would be used as evidence. It was evidence. It was a rape. She was raped. She was handcuffed. She was raped at gunpoint. The videotape that was going to be used as evidence came back edited, with him completely edited out, though you could hear his voice, and her penetrating herself with flashlights and guns. And in a discussion with the prosecuting attorney, we were told that this was not seen as evidence, partly because a month prior to this incident, there had been an incident where they weren't sure whether or not she'd actually consented to being handcuffed. Because there had been a recent experience where she had been handcuffed by the same man, they said that this would now be used as evidence actually against her, that she consented and that she actually, basically the rough sex defense would be used against her. And that was one of the reasons why they declined to press charges. Of course, we expressed great concern that when the county attorney is looking at something that is clearly sexual assault, that they continue to say there is no sexual assault in the videotape. And we continue to say, we know it's in the videotape. We've talked to the victim. And they continue to say there is no assault in that videotape. Because of this woman's past history, it speaks directly to what you're talking about with there are no innocent women. And I think this is a great concern and something that we're going to continue organizing on, as well as looking at law enforcement abuse of women. And we'd be happy to talk to anybody here about your organizing efforts on that as well.
He then said he disappeared when Internal Affairs did their investigation.
The videotape that the victim herself asked the police to confiscate in a search of the police officer's home disappeared and suddenly reappeared when his attorney turned it over to Internal Affairs, who had it for a couple of months, and then turned it over to the county attorney's office, at which point it was clearly edited. Nobody knows if A, John Moorman edited it, B, his attorney edited it, C, Internal Affairs edited, or D, the county attorney's office edited it. At this time, since no charges have been brought, the police officer in question, who is still being paid, by the way, is trying to sue to get his property back out of evidence. That is, the videotape with the coerced pornographic performance by the woman. Since it's locked in the county attorney's office, the next thing that's happened is we've gotten calls from local media people who have seen this edited videotape. So it is actually being distributed. When we asked the county attorney's office if they could do something about the forced pornographic performance, they said that she would have to prove that she did not consent to this. The assumption is she consented. Now, tell us what to do.
Interesting thing I just want to mention real quick is that while all this was going on and we were handing out flyers about the case to get out some information about it, while he was not being charged, while he was still on duty at the Minneapolis Police Department, my job at a rape crisis center was threatened because the board at which I worked was saying that we were causing liable because he was going to come after us and rape us. So we have a real interesting situation where activists, we had a rapist calling our center saying that he was going to get us for exposing this case, and it was an interesting twist that he's still being paid, and yet our jobs are threatened for this.
There is so much to say here, and we can't say it all, but I think I'd like to focus in on a couple things, and then I suspect Kitty will want to, and they are these things. There is, in a certain way, in this conference, there's been, in a way, a friendly but nevertheless real clash of cultures between the legal world and the world of, I would call it the real world of women. But certainly between the legal world and the world of those of us who are activists, and some of us are lawyers and activists, but those of us who really work with what really happens to women. And what I have to say about that is very important because all of the exaggerations that we're accused of whenever we try to generalize around the conditions of women, we're always talking about 100,000 million, I don't even know how many, specific events like the very few you've heard about here today. I mean, you've heard about just nothing. And everyone here who's ever worked in a battered women's shelter, in a rape crisis center, knows that the lives of women are filled with these, again, I stress, ordinary events. And then what the law says to us is, who are you? What do you mean? Prove it. But you like that, you ones? You're weird, you're strange, you're like that. We know that you're like that. You lie all the time. And when we look to political remedies, when we look to change the law to make it friendlier to women so that women can use it, what we find is that the hostility is, in fact, built into the fabric of the law. All right? And there's a real question. I mean, the ordinance really tries to put itself in the center of the legal system and challenge basic premises of the legal system. But we don't even know, using the system of law that we have now, we don't even know that rapists who commit the crime are virtually ever convicted. And that's not even considered to be a test of whether the legal system is a good one or not. I mean, we're all supposed to buy the defense attorney's position that the way you measure a legal system is whether or not an innocent man is acquitted. But what we have to be concerned about, those of us who have been raped, who have never gone near a court, or those of us who have been raped who have tried to prosecute it, is the fact that we see these guys walk all the time. Now, what kind of legal system is this? So the fact of the matter is that we have a legal system that was built on our chattel status, when we were property, when men could do whatever the hell they wanted to us. We're trying to say to them, you can't do that anymore. The law is basically still on their side. Part of what we're trying to do is to move the law to our side, and part of what we're trying to do is to move women out from under the law by any means necessary to places of safety. Now, finally, in terms of what this videotape means, it's very striking. The case that Laura X talked about, the marital rape that was videotaped, the trial, the verdict came in the same week that the Rodney King verdict came in. The social meaning of these two pieces of videotape, and I don't want to be misunderstood about this, because there is no doubt in my mind that there was a time in this country that there still could be in many places when people would look at the Rodney King videotape, as that jury did, and say, it's an uppity one of them. Look at him trying to get up. That's an act of violence. All right? That's a reality. But when women are taped being hurt, these pornographic assumptions about our nature completely predetermine the way the injury is viewed. All right? So what we think that we have that's a record of something bad that happened to us, people look at and say, it's proof that you like it. And the fact of the matter is that very often the people who are looking at it, in particular the men, sometimes the police, sometimes lawyers, sometimes the courts, they like it. They like it. It gives them pleasure. They like seeing women hurt. And that's what we're trying to change. Now, you might talk about it as trying to redeem their humanity. And Mary Matsuda talked about that a little bit this morning. That is part of this. But we're not trying to convince them. We're trying to move society around so that they have to change or die.
I would have one sentence to it, but I would like to hear from this woman, too. And that is just basically that I will think about what can be done about this guy. But until something real is done about and to the pornography, something that shifts its status from being state-protected as it is now to at least questionable, which is what we're trying to do, its legitimacy now defines who all these women are. It defines how our injuries are seen. It defines who we're taken to be by the law. You know? So until something is legally done to change that, it will define our legal realities in front of the law. So that here are women thinking, now maybe I will be believed. And what's believed is the pornography of them. You know, and so, I mean, it's just another way of saying what Andrea said, but, you know, unless and until there is something like the ordinance that makes clear that this can be legally actionable, the pornography of us is going to define who we are in and out of court.
The gentleman to my left.
Well, my name is Mark Golden. I'm an activist, and I'm terrified of speaking in front of groups. I have a short question, but first I'd like to make a short statement. About 3 years ago, I was 20, and I thought the pornography was pretty cool. And I picked up a copy of Ms. Dworkin's Letters from a War Zone because I disagreed with her and read it and was pretty convinced that my previous position was wrong. So I'd like to announce to everybody that men can be reached because I've been reached, and I want to thank Ms. Dworkin for reaching me. My question is, there's a relatively recent phenomenon in pornography called amateur pornography video, in which a supposed husband and wife will make a video and then have it distributed by some main distribution company. And I wonder if Ms. McKinnon or Ms. Dworkin think there's any special significance to that or not, and if so, what is the significance?
Are you talking about these, stay up just a second so I can ask you a couple things. Are you talking about these videos that are allegedly made by two people who are having a wonderful time and then somehow, amazingly, they wind up in the commercial market?
No, what I'm talking about are videos that are supposedly made actually for the commercial market. There was a supposedly an attorney in Texas who would invite construction workers to her home, the story was, and make these videos for her own pleasure and then sell them. And there's these husband-wife pairs that supposedly make these videos, and then they're distributed by some central company.
Yeah, okay, I would describe them as I describe them, in which people are supposedly having a wonderful time, and somehow, miraculously, it winds up in the commercial market. I just see it as the latest marketing device, as an attempt to, indeed, as a partial response to whatever success has been had in... making clear the conditions under which these materials are usually made. This is, to use another fancy $5 word, detumescent to many men. That is, that that they like to think they, other than those for whom pure sadism is the kick, the vast majority have an ideological need to believe that women are having a wonderful time while all of this is happening to us. And the extent to which we make clear that we're not, it's bad for business. So I see this, and, you know, the involving of lawyers, you know, you can still be a pimp and be a lawyer, you know, and all that as just the latest move in an attempt to play into that ideology and to capture it as part of the market. So that, you know, I mean, that's how I see it. I feel not as informed factually about it as we might be, and I hope to learn more about it as time goes on. We have been contacted by some women who did not intend that pictures taken of them would be marketed, and they were. In situations like this, I mean, it happens all the time that women have pictures taken of us and we didn't intend them to be marketed. Sometimes pictures we don't know were taken are marketed. But, I mean, that's the most that I know about it at this time and what I understand about it based on what I know.
Okay. To my right. My name is Connie. I'm from Minneapolis, and I work with Whisper in St. Paul. I've been doing this work with Whisper as a board member and as an activist and worker now for about 4 years. Prior to that, I worked for 10 years in the battered women's movement. I've been to a lot of conferences. I've heard a lot of people talk about violence against women. And when we talk about the fact that men don't want to give up pornography and men don't want to give up prostitution, I can also say that there are some women who don't want to stand alongside women who have been prostituted and women who have been used in pornography. And as I listened to Andrea talk about what do we get to keep, I started thinking about that in relationship to battered women. And with the education that we've done to try to expand the definition of battered women to include women who've been used in prostitution and pornography. And in some cases have been successful. And in some shelters in some states, yes, women who have been used in prostitution and pornography and are trying to escape and need a safe place to go can go to a battered women's shelter. But it is not common, and it is not the majority. And it seems as though battered women who have shelters now and have some minimal protection under the law in some states and have some places to go, which are funded by government and funded by private foundations and corporations, are content to say that these women, not the tainted women, but the good women, the good battered women can come to our shelter. But the other women, you can have those women. And I would like to challenge you to look at your own state and what are the policies of the women's movement and the battered women's movement in your state. Do they include a definition of battering to include prostitution?
this juncture, I would like to express our heartfelt thanks to the Joe and Emily Lowe Foundation, the Butler Family Foundation, Fieldstead and Company, Shayla Adams Foundation, the John D. and Catherine D. McGautha Foundation, Woods Charitable Fund, the Ms. Foundation for Women. Don't leave. We have another important announcement after this. The Ms. Foundation for Women, Nancy Jackman, the AAUW Educational Foundation, the Crossroads Fund, the Funding Exchange, the Global Fund for Women, which earmarked funds for outreach to include Canadian and English women, the Bromfren Foundation from Canada. And I want to note that there are 160 scholarship seats that were made available and possible because of the Ms. Foundation, the Funding Exchange, and Crossroads Fund, and the Woods Charitable Trust. I also want to thank Tony Baker, who is head of the Northwestern School of Law Volunteer Committee, which stuffed the registration packets. And the DePaul students and others who did a tremendous amount of community outreach and press work. To all of these people, we are deeply grateful.
Last 30 seconds of your time, I promise. Logistical update. First, I'd like to thank the audience for their patience. We have indeed gone over time today. We've had the privilege of having many of our speakers, panelists, speak at length. Because they have spoken at such length, we have graciously been allowed to move our final panel till tomorrow. It will be scheduled as a concurrent panel at lunchtime and will meet in classroom 2. I'm very sorry about that. Unfortunately, we're going to lose a number of our audience members had we done this otherwise. Again, at noon in classroom 2, the Civil Disobedience and Direct Action Group will meet. However, will all activists please, one moment please, will all activists stay after I close and come to the front to network? They have requested that this happen. Two more points. The starting time tomorrow is 9 a.m. prompt. We're going to be a little bit more strictly regimented because we do have people who need to meet planes. We must be done at the time we've said we're going to be done. Finally, vans to the Palmer House have been arranged, I understand, and people who are staying there, I think, can pick them up now, and perhaps a second one is actually coming, a return trip. Finally, students, you're invited to our reception, which is happening now, and I think it's only fitting to close this evening with a final thank you of the expression of our thanks and profound inspiration to our last panelists. Thank you, Andrea Dworkin and Catherine McKinnon.